Hello and welcome to the Forum Club. We have passed the one-year mark of the Lakers season. I believe this is something like our 53rd episode of the Forum Club. Started off as the Magic Hour early in the season, transitioned into solely the Forum Club. During the shutdown, we welcomed in Anthony Slater, and we do so again today. What's up, Slater?
Bill, welcome to what is always the playoff ladder. You're experiencing it really the first time, where now this is the fourth series we're talking about it. I love the progression of the playoffs. This is as strange as it's been, you know, covering it from the outside. It doesn't provide to you the city-by-city feel that you get, you know, climbing up the ladder to different West cities, and then you get an East city. But it's fun, right? It's fun to kind of like follow a team through different matchups and see them kind of climb.
And this is the NBA Finals. Like we are at the the ultimate destination of this season. And this Lakers team, which had a goal and really a determination to get here for the first time in a decade, has done it, you know, really in a pretty efficient manner. In terms of taking care of Portland, Houston, and Denver all in five games, really with very little drama, with the exception of Anthony Davis's game two winner in the Western Conference Finals. But it's interesting. I was talking to somebody the other day and who was kind of giving, not me necessarily, but kind of the media a hard time for constantly pointing out the things that could have happened in those previous series and how the Lakers could have lost to Portland and Houston and Denver. And the thing that I keep going back to is those were not made up narratives. Those were not things that were complete stretches just to build tension. There were reasons to think Portland could give the Lakers at least some trouble. I don't think anyone really thought they were going to lose that series. But Houston created matchup problems. Denver was playing exceptionally well. And I think the fact that the Lakers are here in the finals after playing just 15 postseason games so far is a real testament to how they were consistently always that much better than those other teams. Those have all really been great games. There have been a few blowouts along the way, but the majority of those playoff games have come down to the fourth quarter when the Lakers have just, you know, ratcheted up their level of play. They've clamped down defensively and have just been, you know, 5 to 10 points better in the fourth quarter than those other very, very capable playoff teams they've encountered. And that to me has really been the mark of this this playoff run, where the Lakers have just been that determined and that focused.
Yeah, I think it's a testament to their team defense, which is like something that in general, when we break down matchups and stuff, it's just like not discussed as much. You think one-on-one, you know, I mentioned it in the first round. Remember going in, it was like Avery Bradley's gone. How will they ever contain Damian Lillard? But it's like, you know, we got to stop acting like it's Kentavious Caldwell-Pope is just going to be on an island on Damian Lillard all game. You know, you have huge wings behind them. You have schemes that Frank Vogel's drawn up. You have Anthony Davis at all time looming. You can trap, you can double, you can do so many different things that just don't require you to have a just stopper. And the Lakers do not necessarily have what you consider a perimeter stopper. But I think it's been made clear in these playoffs, from Portland to what they did to James Harden and Westbrook and Houston, and even to the Denver series. They have, I don't know, the best defensive basketball. I think we might find that out because Miami's got a lot of really good defensive ingredients. But that, I think, I don't remember if it was Vogel who said this, but that's kind of their third star was their team defense.
It was a great line. It was a great line because we've talked so much throughout this season, and especially going into the postseason, about who was going to step up as the Lakers' third best player. A ton of discussion about whether it was Kyle Kuzma, and if it wasn't Kyle Kuzma, then who could it possibly be? And Frank Vogel at one point said, it's our defense. Our defense serves the role as the third best player. It's certainly the most third most important element. And I thought it was a very astute way of looking at this team that has such a high level tandem at the top, right? I mean, at this point, certainly they've made a case that they're the best tandem in the league, and obviously the best tandem left standing in a two-team playoff. But to me, the Lakers have really acquitted themselves of all those questions about whether or not they have the depth or the support for LeBron James and Anthony Davis. Almost regardless of what happens in these finals, the Lakers could lose, and I think that what they've done up to this point in the playoffs has validated, you know, everything Frank Vogel said over the course of the year, his trust in Rajon Rondo, which, you know, a lot of people, you know, gave them a hard time about, everything that the front office did in the wake of Magic Johnson's resignation. It's been an insane 16 months, maybe, if I'm doing my quick counting right, since we going back to the night Magic Johnson resigned. When you look at the way the coaching hire worked out, the moves they made in the offseason, the Anthony Davis trade, where you ship, you know, half your team to New Orleans to get one guy. It's really validated everything that's happened up to this point, because if you have a chance to get in the finals, if you have a team and a leader like LeBron James who can help, who can get you to the finals, you have to go all in. And the Lakers went all in. They're in a position to win a championship. And it's, I think, validating is just the word I keep going back to, because the number of questions this team has faced for a year and a half, I think they've virtually all been answered. And there's just one left, and that's, can they close it out?
Depth is an interesting conversation right now, because, you know, I've seen a bunch of people, I don't know who sparked the conversation online, but it was basically, hey, the Lakers have the two best players in this series, which they do, but after that, how many Heat players do you count before you get to the next Laker player? And, you know, people are saying you could legitimately get up to eight, and that had, you know, and I'm not even necessarily disagreeing with you. If we went down the list of like Heat players, and particularly Heat players as I peer into the future who I'd rather have, you know, I'm going, obviously, yeah, Bam, Jimmy, you know, Tyler Hero, Jay Crowder's been great. I don't know if you want to throw Iguodala. Is he, you know, what he does better than some of the other guys? But, the thing is, that's been the conversation. Like, hey, Portland might, well.
Every series, yes, I'm glad you're there, because that's been the conversation. Denver, it was the series, yeah, where it's like, oh, Jamal Murray, Jokic, Gary Harris. And, you know, those are players that, you know, are better than the Lakers supporting cast. But the Lakers top two is so good. And then the collective has been so focused. And by the way, Rondo, Dwight, the players who we kind of discount on this team have been there in the big moments for this team. They have absolutely delivered. You know, Markieff Morris to me, you know, had kind of been a waste of a roster spot until you got into that Houston series. Rondo, you know, regular season Rondo was really uninspiring, tepid in every way. He's been kind of the MVP of this team. It's unbelievable.
Well, I would say, like, look, if you were like, would you rather have Gary Harris or Rajon Rondo, either number one moving forward in their careers, I would take Gary Harris. Or, you know, I don't know, if I'm just on like a random team where Rondo's imploded before, I'd be like, oh, give me Gary Harris. But Rondo in this moment, like, he was more important. He was a better player than Gary Harris in that series. Dwight Howard was a better player than what Paul Millsap, I would say, in that series. He was a better player than definitely Mason Plumlee, who I thought might have been the worst player in the series. Like, you know, the Caldwell Pope has had a really consistent playoffs. I'd probably say he's been their third best player. And it's like the Lakers' depth is playing up. And I just think because of the moment, because who their leaders are, the veteran leadership in that locker room, they've been able to steer Rajon Rondo and Dwight Howard, for example, who have been, like I said, disasters in their last stops, like almost out of the league type disasters. They have, you know, I don't know, like captained them to this moment where it's a perfect situation, and they're playing better than their value might be across the league. But that's all that matters. If Dwight Howard is just as impactful as he was in the West Finals, if he's that impactful in the NBA Finals, then he's the, you know, sixth best player in the series. Even if we were lining the list, he's not the sixth best player.
And the other element of that is with Dwight and Rondo is those are two guys who have not tasted the finals in more than a decade each. And this is what they came to LA for. This is why they wanted to align with LeBron James. And so if you give those guys who have it in them to play with the kind of edge we saw in the conference finals and who are motivated, if you give them that sort of opportunity, it's not surprising that they would really rise to that occasion. Like you said, almost out of the league for both of them. The fact that this could potentially be their last shot, or maybe however long they're with the Lakers, their final opportunity to win championships, is a huge motivating factor for two guys who I think you very easily could have seen never getting that opportunity again. So for them to actually summon something a little deeper when that's at stake is not surprising at all to me.
We'll be right back after this.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
I want to zoom out of this matchup before we zoom into it, because you mentioned something there with Dwight, and it's funny, I was doing, you know, because I'm doing this dual role right now where I'm writing Lakers and Warriors, and one of the topics the Warriors are currently in like training camp, and their center spot is in an ugly position right now, where Marquise Chris is probably their starter next year, and Kevon Looney, who's super injury prone, is their only other center on the roster. I am advocating that they should draft James Wiseman. So I kind of wrote a story about that. Talked to Steve Kerr last week about how, like, hey, are you looking at the conference finals with Dwight and Anthony Davis and, you know, Jokic, and the fact that the centers in a lot of ways are like there in front of the Warriors' potential path back next year. And, you know, I was looking at what different veteran centers it might make sense for the Warriors to go after in free agency, you know, potentially with the mid-level. And I kind of thought Dwight was a good option for them. I'm sitting there going, you know what would be a good answer? Like, looking at this, well, what's a good answer for Nikola Jokic? How about the answer that is happening right now in the West Finals, Dwight Howard? So I guess my question to you is, like, what do you think Dwight's future is? And we can even talk Rondo, but because this does feel kind of like a one-time, let's just go after it type thing before your careers are over. But also, like, particularly Dwight's, like, still relatively young and in really good shape and, like, is he going to get like a mid-level type offer to leave the Lakers?
I mean, I almost wonder if it could end up being more than that on a 1 year deal or with a player option where somebody's going to pay a little bit more to get him in there. Because to me, it is, you know, he has been a championship level player for them and a game changer really from the beginning. If you go back to the start of the regular season, he was coming in and making a huge impact off the bench. He's been in tremendous shape. He's much lighter than he was in Charlotte and Washington. He's been healthy after his back surgery. I mean, there hasn't been a single instance of Dwight having any of those recurring injuries crop up. It's kind of been a dreamlike year for him. And he's, by and large, I think, avoided controversy or some of the kind of off-court antics that have made him feel unemployable in the past. You know, I obviously got after him when he was on Instagram Live early in the bubble, twice a day, talking about how he was opposed to vaccines and how he didn't like the mask rules in the bubble. I didn't like that. But put that aside, he has been really a consummate citizen in that locker room, and the players seem to love him. LeBron seems to keep him in line. I think the only thing I'd worry about is, or not even worry, but I would just, if I was bringing him in, I'd want to make sure that we had a culture in place that was going to force him to, you know, really adhere to the culture that was in place. And, you know, the Lakers obviously had that with LeBron. You know, I think the Warriors do as well. I mean, we're obviously a year removed from having really seen it at full force, but, you know, the Steve Kerr, Steph Curry, you know, Klay Thompson triumvirate of leadership is very, very well established. And I think that, you know, it's clear that you either come in and adapt or you're not going to last. And so I think that is one of the few places where I could see Dwight coming in and you know, come in and you play this 20, 25 minute a night role.
He'd start.
I mean, imagine him playing 22 minutes, 23 minutes as a starter and giving them that vertical threat and that back line of defense. I mean, that to me makes a ton of sense. And Slater, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but there was some interest from the Warriors in Dwight way back in 2013 when he left the Lakers. I think he had a meeting with the Warriors before he signed ultimately with Houston.
That money ended up going to Iguodala, and that ended up being a good decision.
Yes. And listen, that's not the Dwight Howard you wanted, by the way. That was not the version of Dwight that you'd be getting now for, you know, $6 million or $10 million, whatever it would be. I mean, this is an evolved Dwight. And this year, though, was such a perfect storm where he was coming out of, you know, real skepticism from the league that he could contribute or be a role player. And he has been repeatedly validated in, you know, his decision to come to the Lakers. He has exceeded expectations. He has completely delivered. And if you start kind of removing some of those doubts or that kind of, you know, forced Dwight to toe the line, does he then start getting comfortable and become kind of the Dwight we've seen before? Because, like, people don't really change.
Yeah, my biggest question would be the on-court. Does he go, okay, now I'm awesome again. Can I get, like, I don't know, 10 post-ups a game?
Right.
You know, can you feature me offensively? How can I be on the billboards? Where it's like, I wonder if this year he did discover what his role in the NBA now is, particularly in a 2020 NBA where he's past his prime. It's like rim run, high energy, irritate, you know, block some shots. And then, hey, this isn't your matchup. Go sit on the bench and clap. And if there is a role acceptance beyond the season, not a, hey, this is a rejuvenation, now I want to be an all-star again.
Right.
That's, you know, a big change, which I want to flip this to the current matchup, because I want to talk about what Vogel might do at the center spot. Because yes, by the end of that series, it was very clear that the smartest move was to start Dwight and have him try to irritate and get Jokic in foul trouble. Now, Miami's a very different beast. They're different than the Lakers have seen at all, but they're more Houston-y in their starting lineup. They have Duncan Robinson, who is a complete floor spacer at the three. Jay Crowder, who's taken 8 threes a game right now, is playing the four spot. And Bam Adebayo is their only big on the floor, and he's not a traditional big. I mean, he's very large, but he is out on the perimeter. He's playmaking. He'll bring the ball up at times. Like, it's almost a five-out system, even though Adebayo is inside sometimes. And that is challenging for a AD Dwight or an AD JaVale front line to play against. So, personally, I think they should take JaVale off the table and say, what makes more sense? Keep Dwight and try to bully ball it, or put Morris or Kuzma in the starting lineup and just play, you know, spread against spread, and have Kuzma guard Crowder and AD's out there with Bam. And it's kind of like a five-out series for both teams.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's not quite Houston-y, right? But it is kind of a case of feeling like who adjusts to who. Because the Lakers could certainly try to really impose their size early on and start Dwight and AD. And really, the Heat, as currently constructed, are not really built to defend that lineup. I suppose Jay Crowder could try to take some time on AD. But the matchup that makes sense for the Heat is Bam on Anthony Davis. And if you've got Dwight Howard out there as well, how do you cope with him defensively? So I think that's going to be absolutely something to watch. I mean, if we talked about a Lakers Heat finals in the regular season, and no disrespect to Miami, which was kind of always right there on the fringe of the mix in the East, you know, probably at least deserved to be in the same level of conversation as like the Philly Bostons of the East, while, you know, you had Milwaukee seeming like the favorite in the East. But now that they're here, you know, I think the Lakers, you know, at least in Vegas, are heavy favorites to win this thing. But is there a reason to be seriously skeptical of the Lakers, you know, cruising through these finals? I mean, can you just look to what they did in Milwaukee? Is that what should be sending off up the red flags?
Yeah, I mean, like, they look great. This is a completely different team than the regular season. Yeah. Heat are. I am as, like, non-confident, however you want to say it, about the Lakers' chances. I picked them in 7, but, like, this is as much of a toss-up series as I can remember going in of the three. Portland, I thought that was overblown.
Right.
Houston, it was like, this has got to be tricky, but the way Houston played against the Thunder was, like, to me, a signal of, like, they're kind of dying a little bit. I mean, they were, like, literally a Lu Dort 3 away from losing to the Thunder.
Right.
So by the time that series showed up, I was like, I don't know about Houston. Denver, it was, you know, the Clippers would have been the biggest challenge of all, but, like, the fact that it was Denver felt like such a relief for the Lakers, like, if you're the Lakers. This one is, like, the way Miami kind of, like, went right through some very good teams in the East. You mentioned the Bucks, right, but even the Celtics, like,
right,
you know, the Celtics were super hot heading in. They just beat the Raptors, and it was, like, I think the Celtics would probably consider slight favorites. And the Heat went up 2-0 right away. And, I mean, you just go back to the regular season matchups. It's like Bam had not taken, like, the 2-level step up that he's at now. You know, he wasn't the scoring, playmaking, confident offensive player. I mean, he's always been the versatile defender, but to me, he's at a different level than the Lakers have ever seen him at. Butler's on a mission, just like we talk about LeBron on a mission. I mean, Jimmy Butler's on a mission. The Lakers did not see them post trade deadline. And in the trade deadline, they got Jay Crowder and Andre Iguodala.
Yes.
And, I mean, that just really toughens up your wing rotation with veteran playoff players. And playoffs are a different level. And, you know, Iguodala, honestly, has looked a little bit washed up, although he hit 4 threes in game 6 and has looked awesome. And he's a good rotation piece, but Crowder's been the revelation. Like, he's still got a lot left in the tank. He shot it well in the playoffs. He really shot Milwaukee out of that series. And then Tyler Hero. I mean, Tyler Hero did not make first-team All-NBA. He was second team All-NBA. Eric Paschal, a guy I covered on the Warriors, made it over him. Kendrick Nunn, who's on the Heat, was third in Rookie of the Year voting. He's now out of the rotation. And suddenly Tyler Hero looks like a future star, at least a star offensive player. And he's microwave scoring off the bench right now. He had 37 against Marcus Smart and Jaylen Brown in a game. He's 20 years old. he leads the all playoff players in bench points. He has 89 more bench points than Kyle Kuzma. And he kind of is the Kyle Kuzma. It's a different type of role. Hero's much smaller. He's a guard. But that's kind of like the expectation what the Lakers had, is to say, hey, randomly, Kyle Kuzma, come off and pop 30 in a playoff game. Kyle Kuzma has not hit 20 once in 15 playoff games, whereas Hero has a 37-point game. He has a 22-point game. Like, he's an X factor in this series. And, like, Miami is not who Miami was in the regular season.
Yeah, I completely agree. You know, and this series has so many great storylines. You know, obviously LeBron and Pat Riley and Frank Vogel and Eric Spoelstra again. But, you know, the one that, you know, I kind of mentally keep going back to is how badly the Lakers wanted to add Andre Iguodala to be sort of that, you know, last kind of piece of their rotation. And they weren't able to pay enough to Memphis. I mean, we saw, you know, what Memphis ended up getting for Andre from Miami. The Lakers didn't have that or weren't going to make that kind of commitment. And he ends up in Miami. And now here he is on the other side in the NBA Finals, which I think is just fascinating because he would have been a perfect fit with this Lakers team. You know, ended up adding Markieff Morris. And again, I don't know that the Lakers really had the assets to make that trade. I suppose they could have sent KCP. There was some talk about Kuzma, but they were never going to trade Kuzma for, you know, basically half a year of Andre Iguodala.
Well, you want to know what the other thing is? Iguodala was very much in control of that situation behind the scenes. And what Iguodala did out of Miami is he made Miami agree to extend him and give him another year of $15 million on the back end of that, which is like, I'm not sure the Lakers would have committed to.
I mean, listen, when that happened, and thanks for reminding me, I'd actually forgotten that. When that happened, of course the Lakers weren't going to do that. But I mean, here they are, they're in the finals. I mean, Miami's not regretting that. Miami could be terrible next year and it was worth it. If that got him there and gave him a chance to win another championship.
I think they're fine because they're like, whatever, we'll commit this money because it's still going to be off the books by the time Giannis is a free agent. And that's Miami. He's just trying to get everything off the books by 2021 for Giannis. But the Lakers, that would make a little less sense. And, like, you know, I mean, Iguodala would be in the Lakers rotation right now. And don't get me wrong, that would help. But I think the Lakers have a pretty steady, you know, rotation that pieces together well right now. I mean, so it's, to me, that's not a huge miss by them.
I think it worked out. I think, you know, when you go back to the kind of the beginning of the year and Andre is just, you know, twiddling his thumbs and waiting for a home, it felt like, let's get this show on the road. Like, he fills the Lakers' needs. But the thing that, like, I continue to be impressed by is how the Lakers have evolved kind of internally. And, like, you've seen Kentavious Caldwell-Pope absolutely evolve into the player they needed him to be. It's not quite manna from heaven, like Rob Pelinka referred to him when he signed his first contract for $18 million with the Lakers. He hasn't quite, you know, godlike, but he has really embraced and thrived in this role. I mean, he took the challenge of stepping up in the absence of Avery Bradley. He has been an extremely consistent three-point shooter. Like you said, I mean, he has been probably the third best player for the Lakers.
He's been better than Danny Green.
He's been better than Danny Green. He's obviously been better than Kyle Kuzma. And he's just consistently probably at a higher level, at least offensively, than Alex Caruso. So, you know, the Lakers have guys internally who are doing everything you would have expected them to be getting from anyone else who they really might have added, you know, to wit, Iguodala.
What is the number one aspect of this series you're looking at going into game one? Like, what part of the matchup?
I mean, I'm excited for the wing defenders that the Heat have going at LeBron. I think this is a different kind of matchup, toughness-wise, than the Lakers have experienced. I think, you know, seeing Jimmy Butler versus LeBron, the way Jimmy Butler is presumably going to try to come at LeBron, the way Dwight went at Nikola Jokic. And I don't think LeBron is a particularly flappable person, but, you know, we talked going into the conference finals about how the Nuggets had waves of guys that could go at LeBron. And we were talking about, you know, Gary Harris.
This is
Torrey
a tidal
Craig.
Wave compared to this like is, a nice this is, little surfing yeah, wave.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, these are dudes who are going to, you know, really try to disrupt LeBron and who are going to body him from 35 feet. I'm excited to see that. I'm excited to see how LeBron responds. I mean, I think, you know, I don't think LeBron has had that great of a challenge in these playoffs. I think for the most part, LeBron has gotten everything he's wanted in all three series. And I think that the Heat are going to make it a lot harder. And not to mention, you've got a guy over there on the opposing sideline who knows LeBron as well as anyone in this series.
Yeah, I think if you just took every single guy who's guarded LeBron in the playoffs and, like, put them up on a list, you know, hey, we're talking Gary Trent and Carmelo, remember that? Or Mario Hezonja, how bad was that first round matchup? Or you took the Rockets, I guess we would put P.J. Tucker up there, but other than that, you know, Eric Gordon.
P.J. Tucker was preoccupied. Yeah, with the Lakers bigs.
Yes, he was. You know, Covington's, you know, okay. And some of the other, like Eric Gordon, some of the other Rockets never really had much of a chance. Even, you know, Gary Harris, solid defender. Paul Millsap can do some stuff, but he's older. I think if we're saying if we're listing them out, I would probably go like Butler, Iguodala, Crowder, like are among the top 3, 4, 5 of guys he's faced. And then honestly, I think Adebayo on LeBron at times in this series. I know we must be preoccupied. And trust me, Adebayo will be preoccupied by Davis, and then we can get to that matchup. But I think he's going to get some shifts on LeBron as like the really long big option because he can really move his feet. So you know what they're going to mostly try to do? They're going to make stuff tough. They're going to bump him. They're going to hope that LeBron doesn't get nearly the calls that he got against a Jamal Murray, for example, because they are older veterans that can talk to referees. And I think they want to make LeBron a jump shooter. And while LeBron closed Denver out with his jump shooting, his jumper has not been super reliable all playoffs. And I think if they force him into enough jumpers, they're going to feel real good.
And I think that's true for the entire offensive scheme and what the Heat want to make the Lakers do. I mean, the Lakers are still not a great three-point shooting team. So they're going to force Danny Green and KCP to make shots because of the way they're going to load up on LeBron and Anthony Davis. And the Lakers have been proficient from beyond the three-point line in these playoffs, but they haven't been, you know, they haven't been exceptional. And so if you can force, you know, the Lakers into the half court offense and force, you know, KCP and Alex Caruso and those guys to be, you know, to make shots to beat you, I think they're going to feel pretty good about their defensive scheme.
Yeah. The 2-3 zone is interesting. I wrote a bunch about that in the preview I did, but you know, that's how Miami flipped the conference finals. They dropped really in game two. They kind of sprinkled it in game one, but they were up 1-0, and then game two, like Spoelstra really went to it to try to steal game two, and like Boston got out of sorts. They were getting a bunch of turnovers, kind of like thrown into the active arms. They were trying to figure out like where the soft spots to attack. They missed some threes, which I feel like sometimes when you play a zone, you're kind of more weirded out, you know, hesitant from three. And if you're not hitting threes over the zone, then it's working typically as long as you rebound. But I, you know, I looked at some of the film and Miami did play it, I think 40 total possessions against the Lakers in the regular season. And the Lakers were generally pretty successful against it. They had a bunch of offensive rebounds in the first matchup because, you know, when you're in a zone, you're not really assigned to box a guy out and it's much easier. Like Davis attacked the glass for a couple rebounds. Kuzma did. But you know, and they did do this interesting thing where they had Davis sit kind of right in the middle of the zone and they would lob it to him and he had some success there. So there are ways, and I know Frank Vogel and that staff is talking about it the next 2 days, ways to attack the 2-3 zone because of how well it worked and the fact that they're probably going to use it against the Lakers. But you know, if the Lakers don't hit threes over the top of it, and if Miami's really, you know, aggressively rebounding out of it, that could become a story in early in the series of like, you know, the Lakers' ability to solve that or not.
Yeah, I mean, this series to me is just going to be probably the greatest test of will that the Lakers have had so far. You know, where there is going to be a team that really just challenges them defensively and forces them to get to those next levels. I mean, I think that there was, you know, while Portland was hot coming in and Houston was pesky or, you know, whatever, and Denver was getting those great contributions from Jamal Murray, I didn't feel like there was really ever a great threat to this Lakers team. With Miami, I feel like if you give them a little bit of breathing room, there is an actual threat here. Because I mean, listen, nobody really saw Miami winning, you know, in that second round against Milwaukee, and the next thing you knew they were up 3-0 and it was over. So, you know, I don't see the same thing happening here, but could I see them winning game one? Absolutely. And then all of a sudden, you know, game two becomes do or die. And so I'm really interested to see how the Lakers come out in this series because, to me, if you open the door at all for Miami, they're going to barge through like they have in all three series, swept the Pacers, beat the Bucks in five, beat the Celtics in six. And they went up big in both those series. Obviously the sweep 3-0 against the Bucks and then 2-0 against the Celtics. They have really come out firing and really locked in and determined in every series. And the Lakers, as we've seen, have been a little susceptible in game ones. And that is something you really can't afford to let happen in this finals.
If I told you you were going up against Anthony Davis in a series and you get your choice of defenders in the entire league, I mean, you're probably taking Giannis one. I mean, yeah. First of all, you're taking Giannis just because you know you're also getting Giannis, but... like, just if we're just talking about pure isolation defenders, one-on-one defenders against Anthony Davis, I mean, Bam's got to be top three.
Right.
I mean, you're taking him over Gobert. I mean, would you take Davis to guard Davis? It's almost a little bit like Davis is guarding Davis. You know, it's very similar size, very similar length. I would say a bit quicker, not as strong, but very strong. And not only that, in ascending Bam, where I don't think we can yet say, oh man, he's gonna like stop Davis. But after this series, we might have an opinion about Bam as a defensive menace, that he's already kind of getting there. And yes, a lot of his best work is done help side. I mean, his highlight play of his career was that block at the rim on Tatum to seal the win. And that was help side. But he can be a good, just straight up me on you type defender. And I looked at some of the film, and Davis in his past has really baited Bam into fouls, which I think will be an early game strategy, because you get him in foul trouble just like they did Jokic. That changes the game. But man, I mean, like if Bam can really lessen Davis's efficiency, then I mean, it's the same thing that wave of wings is trying to do to LeBron. You just try to make these guys, instead of going 11 of 17 shooting, they're, you know, 9 of 21 shooting. That changes the game.
I think the thing about this matchup is that there's more straightforward matchups for the Lakers' best players. You know, if you have Bam on AD, which I think is like you said, a great matchup. It's very, to me, it's not even close to a push. AD is the better player, but that is a guy who if you're Miami, you feel good about putting him out there one on one with AD, you know, to start the series. And then the same with LeBron. You have guys that you feel very comfortable with matching up with AD, which allows you to, if you're not in the zone, obviously play it a little more straight with the rest of the roster. So I am all in on the idea that Bam Adebayo is going to be a nuisance for AD, or is going to be a challenge. And going back to what you said about this Heat team being different from the regular season, they have looked every bit a championship contender really from the start of these playoffs. Jimmy Butler has been, you know, probably the MVP of the East. Goran Dragic has been, you know, Phoenix Dragic, Tyler Hero. I mean, just everything about like this Heat team.
The Dragic rejuvenation is like the very under discussed story in their rise. Like he's, I think, leading the team in like shot attempts and maybe even points.
It's funny because you go back 4 or 5 years when he signed that contract with Miami, he was a super sought after free agent. And there was, you know, some thought at one point that the Lakers would pursue him, and you know, he locked in on, or did he get traded to Miami and then resign? How did that work?
Yeah, it was a little bit like the Iguodala one.
Where yeah, it was like
they made the trade, and then they traded. Yeah,
they gave him like a 5-year max or something like yeah. that. It's really underwhelmed is the point until now. I mean, now he's like completely living up to that contract.
Well, he had like a bad knee injury at one point, and I remember like he was coming back from it. I can like vividly remember sitting in an arena. I believe it was probably Warriors Heat, and like watching him really get toasted defensively, and he's wearing a knee brace, and it was like almost uncomfortable. It's like, oh man, his career, like, you know, rough injury luck there, but he just can't move anymore. I thought honestly, going into the season, he was considered like an expiring deal that the Heat would love to get off, like a very bad albatross of a contract. Now suddenly he's in the NBA finals as the guy who's taking the most shots on the East champ. Like, that is pretty stunning. And then the other thing I'd say we haven't necessarily talked about with, like, the Lakers on the flip side guarding Miami, it's a different test because you think about, you know, you had the Lillard-centric offense, the Harden-centric offense, and then, you know, it was Murray Jokic, but it was, you know, it was still that star young scoring guard that can shoot from deep, and then, you know, Jokic is his own task. But the Heat are, like, very different where they, you know, they don't really have, like, a young, dynamic, explosive scoring guard. And, you know, you consider Hero off the bench, but I just mean that's like the center of their offense. But what they do have is like they have these shooters that really space the floor. Duncan Robinson is like just kind of a weird guy to track. He's never going to dribble. He's kind of like Klay Thompson light out there. And then Adebayo is kind of like the playmaking five, and like Butler, who is the star of the team, like you don't really mind if he's taking jumpers at all, but he is still going to kind of slither in and get his points. But there's going to be games where Jimmy Butler might take 7 shots and barely be like, he'll still be a big factor in the game, but he won't be super aggressive offensively. This Heat team really pokes you from so many more different ways than the star players that the Lakers played in the West.
I feel like you can maybe get away with Danny Green on Jimmy Butler early on. But like late in games, that's going to need to be LeBron's assignment, because I think for the most part, Jimmy's going to be able to go through the Lakers defenders and get to his preferred spots, kind of inside 15 feet, get to the rim against KCP. So I think that, you know, we're going to have to see, you know, great championship level defensive LeBron again in the fourth quarter, which, I mean, you've written about, which we got in the Western Conference Finals. But to me, that seems like where we're going to have games decided on, you know, who wins that Jimmy LeBron matchup in the fourth quarter.
Yeah. And, you know, it might depend on the night. Like Butler, I remember in game one of the Bucks, like really, I think he might have had like 40, and like down the stretch, he really went off. And the story post game was, remember, it was like, hey, Giannis, why didn't you take Jimmy Butler? But then by the middle to later that series, Jimmy Butler was no longer the offensive star. And it was like random guys on random nights. Suddenly Duncan Robinson hit a bunch of threes, or Crowder did. You know, Heroes had a few nights where, if game four of the Celtics Heat is happening and Tyler Hero's going off, you might not say, hey, LeBron, we need you to guard Jimmy Butler down the stretch. You might be, hey, LeBron, can you go shut off Tyler Hero? Because he's like winning this game right now. So that's just the difference. It's like with Denver, it was never going to be like, hey, Jamal Murray is, or I mean, it was never going to be, hey, Gary Harris is the guy you got to go shut down, or like maybe a little Porter Jr., but you never felt like Porter Jr. was going to take over. He just might hit some threes that helped.
Then for the Lakers, it really needs to be LeBron or AD that's doing that, because we haven't really seen any of their other guys, with the exception of some, you know, fourth quarter bursts from Rondo, really establish themselves offensively. I mean, the fact that Kyle Kuzma still doesn't score 20 points in a game, it baffles me. And not saying that they need him to average 20, but it's like you would expect him, somebody that is that offensively minded, to give you at least one of those signature kind of Kyle Kuzma nights. And I wonder if maybe we'll finally get it in these finals, because like we talked about, I mean, there are some conventional matchups for LeBron and Anthony Davis, and does that create a space for Kyle Kuzma to maybe finally go off in one of these? Because I think you are right that the Heat ultimately have more weapons and more guys who can have big nights and rise up and beat you, even if you take everything else away. If the Heat can somehow, and this is all tall order, don't get me wrong, but if they can somehow take away LeBron and AD, or even just limit those guys, who's that next Lakers player who's going to step up and just roast the Heat? I don't know that we haven't seen in the playoffs that there really is that guy. And, you know, Lakers fans have been hoping for it and waiting for it and have survived without it. But at some point, it feels like Kyle Kuzma has to get his.
Let's kind of back out of the X's and O's part of the matchup and look at it more from like the dramatic standpoint of it isn't Lakers-Celtics from a brand standpoint. But, you know, this is kind of what you wrote about a little bit, is like there is some denseness to the rivalry, even if it's not an on-court rivalry. It's kind of what has gone on in the history of the big figures. And obviously the Pat Riley, Miami Heat, LeBron connection, and Spoelstra the other night, like not having LeBron when he was talking about like, this is for, you know, Udonis and Chris Bosh and Dwayne Wade, and he doesn't mention LeBron. you have all that looming over it. I mean, Vogel, who's, you know, we didn't talk much about Vogel because Vogel never gets talked about much, but he does have that Indiana Pacers, Miami Heat history.
The Heat have been the roadblock in his career of being able to get to that ultimate goal. And you're right. I mean, to me, this is a much more dramatic series from a storyline standpoint than a 13th Celtics-Lakers finals would have been. And it's one of the greatest rivalries in sports, but there's really no, you know, cultural currency between these two,
these two,
the personalities on the Lakers and Celtics. I mean, it would just be that there's gold and green on the court, and that evokes a certain feeling. And don't get me wrong, that would have been great. The league would have loved that, but the league is not crying about getting LeBron versus Pat Riley and, you know, those two trying to settle kind of an old score, Eric Spoelstra trying to outwit, you know, his former star. You know, there just is a lot to this series in terms of storylines and drama. And I mean, you know, I mentioned the Iguodala thing. Jimmy Butler was a free agent last year when the Lakers had a ton of cap space. They basically chose not to pursue him, to go all in on Kawhi. I knew people within the Lakers organization who were like, let's not waste our time with Kawhi. Go get the guy we can get Jimmy Butler. And who knows if they actually could have gotten him, but there is, you know, at least a little bit of a history there. To me, I just feel like there's a lot of juice. I think there's a lot of reason for the people in this series to come in already kind of angry at the other side.
What do you think about the Riley LeBron stuff and really more like just LeBron and like the Heat organization and like where that stands going into this? Because it was a successful 4-year partnership, but it does seem to be a little bit of behind the scenes thorniness, where like the Cavaliers, when he left that first time in Cleveland, like it was very public. This was kept private,
more behind the scenes. Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of, you know, Pat Riley kind of throwing, you know, a little bit of shade on LeBron when he left, and questions about whether or not basically LeBron had wronged Pat Riley after all he'd done to get him championships, essentially. That said, I feel like it's kind of water under the bridge. It felt like that had kind of resolved itself and those bridges had been restored. I just don't know if we're just digging it out again because it makes for good, compelling drama now that it's an NBA Finals matchup, or if there actually might be something there. But I have no doubt that Jimmy Butler is using it as fuel, that it's, you know, it's not only is it LeBron, not like you need a lot more fuel when it's LeBron, but it's the guy who last led your franchise to a championship, and you're really the first franchise player to come in short of Dwayne Wade, who was obviously, you know, in the final days of his career over the last few years, to kind of come in and get them back to this point. You're the new face. I think that there's probably some fuel there. I'm sure Spoelstra is using all kinds of LeBron stories and things like that as psychological motivation for his team. I don't have a great feel for where that relationship between LeBron and Miami is, but we are going to hear a lot about it over the next 2 weeks.
I do like that Riley's there and sitting up there and wearing his mask in like a little like glass booth the entire time, because like a lot of what we've been missing in these playoffs is the crowd shots, the shots of like Adam Silver sitting over there and like this celebrity's here and like this happened behind the scenes in the tunnel and this was the walk, and like we're missing a lot of that because everything's so isolated right. And away from like civilization. But this entire Heat run, I have very much enjoyed after every game, during games at times where they pan up and it's like Riley clapping and pointing down at Jimmy Butler and just, you know, you think ABC might play Riley up a little bit in the broadcast? Like how many, like what's the over under on like Pat Riley pans over?
Well, it's going to be LeBron hits like a dagger three and the camera's going to go straight to Pat Riley, just stone faced, not moving a muscle or a single hair out of place. And it's going to help build that drama. It's going to be the same.
It'll feel more like a regular NBA sporting broadcast where you do show people that aren't necessarily like the players during the broadcast.
Right. Having a human reaction.
Yes. Yeah. You know what else is not just like Pat? It's not like Pat Riley doesn't have history with the Lakers. I mean,
oh, yeah, exactly.
You know, it's just like that. There's just a lot of layers to it for sure.
Listen, I mean, this feels like a gajillion years ago, but when Magic Johnson quit, there was very briefly some conversation around the league with people who thought that Jeannie Buss needed to go find a way to get Pat Riley out of Miami. Now, there was a lot to untangle there. I think there's an ownership stake with the Heat and all that. So that was probably a long shot all along. But there was a brief thought that there was maybe some momentum behind bringing Pat Riley home. And obviously, I mean, the Lakers stayed the course with Rob Pelinka. He, again, going back to the validation conversation, has completely acquitted himself with the roster he built around LeBron and obviously getting Anthony Davis here. But, you know, Pat Riley with the Lakers, he is in some ways right there with Magic Johnson, you know, the face of the Showtime Lakers, slicked back hair, roaming the sidelines at the Forum, just an absolute Lakers icon, played for the Lakers in the 70s, becomes the coach. I think the only thing I kind of miss, if Magic hadn't stepped down, if Magic Johnson had continued to run this team and things had worked out exactly the same, which to be honest, they probably wouldn't have. Magic Johnson versus Pat Riley in the finals would be as big of a storyline as
Magic
anything else.
Would Magic be up in a glass booth too? I don't know if Magic was coming. What if Magic just showed up now? I mean, it's like, because that's the second tier. You can, I think technically if you come in and you take a test on your way in the arena, you're like allowed to wear a mask and sit up.
Under what auspices though? I mean, he's a fan at this point. He has no official capacity with the Lakers.
Let me tell you this. If Magic Johnson told Adam Silver or whoever, hey, I want to come and be a part, you know, I just want to walk. I'm not going to be in the bubble, but I'll be where Pat Riley is, essentially. They would let him.
I'm big on technicalities. You can't let one fan in the building. It opens the floodgates to all the fans. Jimmy Goldstein would have a legitimate gripe if Magic Johnson could get into tier two of the bubble, and he couldn't.
I can hear
Diane Cannon.
First of all, Jimmy Goldstein might be able to get into tier two as well. Now, can my neighbor get into tier two? No.
Is Jimmy Goldstein your neighbor? Do you live in the Hollywood Hills?
That would be terrific. If Jimmy Goldstein was my neighbor, I'd probably be in a different profession, most likely.
Not doing this podcast?
Yeah, that too. All right, I took Lakers in seven. I do think this is going to be thorny. Can we get you on the record before this podcast is done?
I feel like you can't disrespect the Heat after all they've done. So Lakers in five would be disrespectful. I kind of just thread the needle with Lakers at six. I think the Lakers are the better team. I think the Lakers are the more determined team. I think the Lakers have just the best unit right now. I think the Lakers are going to win this series in six.
Regardless of like the exact number that it goes or even who wins, but mostly what I'm like, you know how the Lakers went 5-5-5 in the lead up? Not every five felt built differently. Like Denver felt like the toughest of the five.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely.
Whatever the Heat go down in, if they go down, I'm not like, like I said, I picked Lakers in seven, which tells you that I think it could easily be Heat in seven because
sure.
Game seven's a game seven. But I think even if, let's say, the Lakers do play really well and end up, you know, doing this in five or even in six, it's not going to feel like a Blazers five.
Right.
Like, no. This is going to be, I think, tough to the finish. Even when they're up 2-0, I expect Miami to come in with punching in game three. I don't expect any type of laydown.
I agree. And by the time we talk next, by the way, we are going to be several games into this series. We'll have one team up in this series. We're going to have a clearer idea of where it's headed. We're going to know if it's lopsided. We're going to know if it's been, you know, three or four two-point, you know, thrillers. I'm excited. I'm excited to start watching it Wednesday night. We'll talk about it next week on the Forum Club. Anthony Slater, thank you as always for your time and insight. One quick programming note. If you are a Laker fan and you've made it this far in the podcast, then you absolutely will want to listen to this week's episode of Tampering with Sam Amick. He had two phenomenal guests last week. That was me and Anthony Slater. This week, he has someone who's almost as good, Lakers owner Jeannie Buss, who gets into the last decade of the Lakers rebuild, her relationship with Kobe Bryant, Rob Pelinka, all the really important topics that have kind of surrounded the Lakers organization. It's a fantastic episode of Tampering on the Athletics NBA podcast show. Please check that out and continue to read and support the Athletic. We have tons of great coverage getting you ready for this finals, and we will through all seven games, as Anthony Slater predicted. Thank you for listening.